for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The famous motto goes, neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. But now a financial storm could shut down postal service this winter. Earlier this month, Postmaster General Patrick Donahue testified before Congress that the USPS needs emergency action to stabilize its finances. He suggested a series of painful cost-cutting measures. Later in the program, we'll talk to the head of a postal union about those cuts. But now, joining me in the studio, Postmaster General Patrick Donahue. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
It's good to have you
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me on.
And I'm sure many of our listeners will want to join the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And when you hear those words, Postmaster General, what do you think?
Well, it's different ways of communicating. People are changing habits. It's a lot of change in demographics. Younger people use Twitter and Facebook, and that has had some effect on our volume, but it doesn't really diminish the value of mail. We know mail is still a great way to get your message across.
Absolutely, but how close is the post office to default?
Here's where we stand right now. As a matter of fact, last night we saw that the Senate passed the continuing resolution, which is a good thing for us because what that does is it allows the government to push a bill that we have due on the 30th back about 60 days. We have to make a $5.5 billion payment to pre-fund retiree health benefits, and what the CR has done is allowed us to wait until the end of November before we have to make that payment.
I want to ask you first and foremost about that pre-funding of employee health benefits. How did that come about? Explain what it is.
Here, the background is this. Back in 2006, there was a law change that was put into effect for that was set up for the Postal Service going forward. The idea was not a bad idea to pre-fund retiree health benefits. It was the responsible thing to do at the time. Also, at the time, we were delivering 213 billion pieces of mail. What's happened over the course of the last 4 years between electronic diversion of first-class mail and the economic downturn, we've lost about 23 to 24% of our volume. What that's done is it has made this payment extremely hard. The idea behind the payment to start with was if you look ahead with the Postal Service, right now we have about 460,000 people who are in our retirement plans, and they get health benefits paid to some extent. The Congress felt it was important to pre-fund while we still had good revenues coming in, because in the long run, if our revenues would go down, we wouldn't be able to make those payments. Problem is, the revenues went down faster than expected, and that's the situation we find ourselves in now.
So do you believe you should continue to pre-fund those health benefits?
Here's where we are right now. We have pre-funded to the tune of $42 billion. We have $42 billion in the bank with the federal government for this. What we'd like to do is to change our health benefits programs going forward. We've got a proposal in front of Congress and the administration right now that says move out of the OPM, Office of Personnel Management, health benefits plans that exist. Let us take over our own plan like any other company would. And as a matter of fact, if we did that, we'd be able to go through a number of steps to eliminate the need to pre-fund any longer.
So you're in this awkward position of being under the federal government, but you want to behave as though you were a private corporation.
Well, it's kind of a combination of both. The government expects us to behave like a private corporation, too. We've got universal service mandates, but at the same point, we take no taxpayer money. We don't want taxpayer money. We are self-sufficient as an organization. Want to stay that way.
So where does the $75 billion sit?
The question of the $75 billion that is overpaid into civil service. Well, here's the situation. The Postal Service has paid $196 billion into civil service. We are fully funded on our retirement health plans for both civil service employees and the newer retirement system, federal employee retirement system. So we're probably one of the only companies in the United States that's fully funded, along with another $42 billion that we've pre-funded for health benefits. So we're in very good shape that way. There is a discrepancy or an argument that says that, in fact, we've overpaid into civil service by an additional $75 billion. When I say a discrepancy or an argument, some people say we have, some people say we haven't. And so my feeling on the whole thing has been this. There's been discussions of using that money to move across to pre-fund the retiree health benefits and eliminate that payment. We're fine with that if the Congress wants to move in that direction. We floated the idea of taking our of our own health benefits, because if the first solution doesn't happen, we have to get out from underneath this pre-funding. So I would propose we take the second route if we can't get the $75 billion.
Help me understand, is there any other agency within the federal government that is forced to pre-fund health benefits in the same way that the post office has been charged with?
The only ones we know who have done any pre-funding is Department of Defense at about a 30% rate. We're funded right now at about 50%. There are no other agencies. We don't know of any other private companies that pre-fund anywhere to the rate that we do.
So if you were not forced to pre-fund, what would happen to all that money?
Here's the thing. Right now, the $42 billion that's already pre-funded, we would need that to cover employee health benefits going out into the future. That's critical that we have that. We do have, like I say, a second solution that eliminates the need for any additional pre-funding. That's one course that we could take. One way or the other, we have to move away from the pre-funding, because with the volume loss and the revenue loss we've experienced, we can't afford that going forward. It will bankrupt us.
So what happens then to the current employees who would retire? Would they have those health benefits going forward?
Yes, they have health benefits now. This whole the whole discussion is pre-funding for the future. And what we're looking to do is approach it in a different way, as far as changing the way we actually what is the basis for the pre-funding. Just to give you an example, one of the things we've looked at with our own plan is this: if you run your own health plan in the private sector, you have people who are required to use Medicare. The Postal Service today does not require retirees to use Medicare. 84% of our retirees participate in Medicare A, 67% in Medicare B, and by law, we're not allowed to participate in Medicare D, which is the pharmaceutical plan. Guess who is the second largest contributor to Medicare? The Postal Service. We'd like to take advantage of the money that we and our employees put into that system. And that's part of how you eliminate the pre-funding, using some of those other solutions.
So I've heard that President Obama is in favor of a five-day week service. How does he feel about this pre-funding argument?
Well, here's where the White House has weighed in this way. They've said that they've said that the pre-funding at this point has to be addressed. They are not in favor of moving the $75 billion. They also have responded to our suggestions about taking our own plan over, saying that's an intriguing idea, but they're not ready to embrace that either. So we've got what they're saying is, let's take a couple years, eliminate the pre-funding, examine and look at all options, and come up with the best solution. We're fine working with them on that proposal.
And what about the Congress? What are they saying now?
You've got a number of different approaches in Congress. There are from the Senate. The Senate has looked at the pre-funding issue, moving money from the civil service overpayment. There are other people in the House that have said that shouldn't be done and that we should make other changes in our system in order to continue to meet our responsibilities to do the pre-funding.
And what is the implication of the continuing resolution? Are you expected to begin to resolve this issue?
There's a lot of interest right now. We're very thankful that the administration has weighed in. That sets a good framework up. There's a lot of activity going on right now in both the House and the Senate on both sides of the aisle. So everyone understands that we've got to get this resolved. I think what happens with the CR timeframe, that gives us a couple months to get legislation pushed through and taken care of in time before the end of the calendar year.
Patrick Dutney, who is the 73rd Postmaster General of the U.S. He's a 35-year postal veteran. Tell me how you got started.
I got started in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, working the afternoon shift starting in 1975.
Doing what?
I was sorting mail and worked in the afternoon shift, and I was going to school at the University of Pittsburgh in the morning. So morning at school, jumped in the car, drove down to the post office, and worked from 3 to 11:30 every night.
How'd you manage that?
I missed most of the 70s.
And married with a family?
Married in 77 after I graduated from school, and I've got a wife and two sons. My sons are 29 and 25.
So you really have worked your way up through the ranks.
Yeah, so it's been a very interesting career, and it's a great place to work. And a lot of good things that come of the career, both personally and for the work that we do for the American public.
Patrick Donahue, Postmaster General of the U.S. We'll talk further, take your calls. I look forward to hearing from you. If you just joined us, the Postmaster General of the U.S. is here in the studio. He's a 35-year postal veteran. His name is Patrick Donahue. And right now, he is facing lots of challenges. Tell me about the cuts that you are proposing to try to get over this hurdle.
Here's the situation we face, Diana. If we do nothing over the course of the next few years, I'm talking 3 or 4 years, we will be in the hole from a net income standpoint by about $18 billion. What we're proposing between now and the end of 2014 is to take our expense line down by $20 billion, and it's a combination of some legislative activities, the resolving this retiree health benefit payment and moving from 6 day to 5 day, some internal network things that we can control, reducing the number of facilities, reducing the number of post offices, and working with our unions going forward on more flexibility within the contracts, and along with some additional what we call non-personnel cost reductions. But all told, we take the $20 billion out, we would become profitable, we get back on our feet financially and be in good shape and then stable going into the future.
You're talking about laying off as many as 120,000 workers. That's tough.
We have reduced the headcount in the Postal Service by almost 250,000 people since the year 2000. Our people have done a great job. They've been very productive, and they've done a very good job in tough, trying circumstances, because as you make these changes, you're constantly having to change the work and the work locations where people are at. We've put this proposal forward in what we call a white paper to Congress, saying we could lay off up to that number of people. Hopefully, what we'd be able to do is we work through these changes, working with unions, working with Congress. There are some other solutions there as far as kind of a what we would call a soft landing for people. What we've been able to do over the course of time with the headcount reduction is do it all through attrition, and we're very proud of that.
You know, every year as the rounds of base closings occurs, you hear protests from every part of the country where these bases are. Think about what you are facing as you close post offices that are far more personal yep. to people. I mean, what is it going to mean to tiny communities who have just one tiny little post office to go to?
Yeah, we're working through that right now. It's what we're trying to do as we make those changes is to improve what we call access, and that's a lot of these post offices are open 2, 3, 4 hours a day, and what we're looking to do is to work with, say, a local store under contract, and then you'd have a 7-day access.
So you'd have a grocery store that takes over.
Yes, and the town would keep its name, the town would keep its zip code, but we are very understanding and sympathetic to people's concerns. And from a positive standpoint, we're very happy that people still worry about the Postal Service, and that's why we've got to figure out how we get all of these issues resolved to the best of our ability without negatively hurting our customers.
Because we all love the mail.
Yes, thank you. We're happy to hear
that. You know, Republican Congressman Darrell Issa's proposed a bill that would create an emergency oversight board to recommend cost-cutting ideas. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've said this to Chairman Issa. I think that it's our responsibility to do what we need to do ourselves from a standpoint of managing our networks and some of the other things that we do. We need to make sure that from our own perspective, we address these issues first before we'd have somebody come in from the outside to tell us what to do.
Because you're worried about what that might mean.
Well, you never know. If you put your fate in somebody else's hands, you never know what the outcome would be. And especially if it's people that do not understand the needs of the customers and what happens from an employee standpoint, you could have some things happen that would not be in everyone's best interest.
A decade ago, the Postal Service had nearly 900,000 employees. How many do you have now?
Right now we have about 559,000 career employees and another 90,000 what we call non-career, people that work generally on Saturdays in some of these small post offices. So we're substantially smaller than we were 10 years ago.
And if layoffs had to happen outside of attrition, wouldn't that hurt African Americans more than any other part of the employee base?
I'm not sure that would have any specific. We employ about 22% of our workforce is African American. I don't know that there would be any larger percentage that way or not. Again, it's our goal to try to move towards additional attrition. We have 157,000 people that can retire right now, full retirement, and we've got another 100,000 in the next 5 years that would be eligible. So working through a number of potential options, we think that we can move a lot of people off the rolls that way.
Are those postal employees eligible for Social Security?
It depends. If you, we have two retirement plans. One retirement plan, a person wouldn't be eligible for Social Security, but it's a pretty reasonable retirement when you leave. Let's say you have 35 years like me, you'd be able to leave with about 60% of your pay. Our second plan is a little less generous from a standpoint of retirement, but you would also be eligible for Social Security because you've had to pay into it all these years.
All right. Now, joining us by phone is Frederick Rolando. He's president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. How are you? Good morning, Pat.
Hey,
I'm fine, thank you. You, I gather, think that the media and the public are misinformed about the problems with the post office. Explain what you mean.
Well, yeah, thanks for that opportunity. What we hear over and over is that the Postal Service is broke, they're obsolete, they're looking for a bailout and so forth. And I think it's important that the public understand that, in fact, the Postal Service is nowhere near broke, certainly not obsolete, and by no means looking for any kind of taxpayer bailout. As Pat indicated, we haven't used a dime of taxpayer money in almost 30 years, so we're not talking about any tax funds whatsoever.
So how do you think those stories get started?
Well, I think they're pretty easy to, they make headlines. Postal Service is broke, obsolete, looking for a bailout. You can do it in one sentence.
But wait a minute. Surely that doesn't come out of the head of a reporter, isn't it coming from members of Congress?
I think it's the same problem. I think it's a matter of educating people. If you look at the last four fiscal years of the Postal Service, operationally, they made almost $700 million. All of the reported losses that we read about and the congressmen speak of are solely from the pre-funding payments that have been required during that time, which totaled about $21 billion. So it was a matter of basically all the cash was drained out of the Postal Service operating budget to put into this fund.
All right. So now this afternoon, there are a number of rallies across the country being held by postal workers. What are you hoping that these will do?
Basically, what we want to do is we want to thank the members of Congress. We're holding these rallies in every congressional district in the country this afternoon to thank the members of Congress that are supporting bills that would help the Postal Service and encouraging those that are not co-sponsors to co-sponsor those particular bills. And specifically, we're addressing Congressman Lynch's H.R. 1351, which would address the surplus in the Civil Service Fund. And we're basically just out to thank the congressman and to inform the public of what's going on. We're going to have handouts for the public to explain the financial situation of the Postal Service.
So you think that the public is literally being misinformed, that we don't quite get it as far as the clear situation you're in? Why then are the Postmaster General, the President of the United States, and members of Congress asking for a 5-day postal delivery service?
Well, I can't speak for all of them, but I think a lot of people are assuming that if Congress doesn't act responsibly or doesn't act at all, or if nothing is done to adapt to the needs of how Americans are using the Postal Service, that's the answer. And I think that's where Pat and I tend to disagree, is I think we need to concentrate on not only the Congress giving the Postal Service access to their own money, but we then have to look ahead and figure out how we can adapt the existing networks to how the nation uses the mail, rather than starting to dismantle the Postal Service.
You know, give me an example of what you mean by adapting the existing service.
Sure. For example, the internet certainly brings challenges to what we do, but it also offers a lot of opportunities. People are shopping online now, which opens up the opportunity to deliver what they buy door-to-door, the last-mile delivery. FedEx and UPS also, one of their fastest-growing divisions is the division where they drop off packages to the Postal Service for residential delivery because it's a good deal for them. It's a good deal for us. We go to every house every day. They may go to every 50th house, every 500th house. That's just an example of how the Internet would offer an opportunity.
So, wait a minute. Explain how that last-mile delivery would work.
With regard to the other companies?
Yeah.
Yeah, what they do is they drop the parcels off at Postal Services, and we do the last-mile delivery at the post office.
And you think that then that would be a cost-sharing endeavor?
Well, yeah, I think if we can expand the last-mile delivery, we do not only for them but other delivery companies, it just makes sense because we can do it much cheaper.
Okay, and let me ask you, Frederick, what you think would happen to future retiree health benefits if that requirement to pre-fund is ended?
Well, as Pat indicated, there are no other federal agencies or companies that are required to do that. We're the only ones to do it. What we're essentially doing is pre-funding future retiree health benefit premiums for a 75-year period for people that may not even work for us yet, in some cases for people that aren't even born yet. We're double funded of any corporation that voluntarily does it percentage-wise. So I don't see any adverse effect in allowing the Postal Service access to the amount of money that's in that account that's over and above what anybody else is required to do.
Frederick Rolando, he's president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'd like to ask each of you, starting with you, Frederick, what you believe would be the effect of losing Saturday service?
Well, I think it would adversely affect a lot of residents, a lot of businesses. I don't think it makes good business sense to eliminate 17% of your service to save anywhere from 2 to 4 to 5% of your costs. I don't think any business would adopt that formula. I think it's dangerous because a lot of the growth that we would be looking for in the future involves the delivery of parcels, the last-mile delivery. Saturday is the day that people are home. I just think it's an opportunity for growth. It's our competitive edge, having Saturday delivery. There's a need for Saturday delivery. If we don't do it, somebody else is going to step in and do it. And I just believe it puts the Postal Service in a bad business position for the future.
And what about you, Postmaster General?
The situation we face is this: we will keep our post offices open on Saturday, so we will customers will have access. They'll also have access to post office box delivery if they need packages or mail delivered. We'll also run our network, so things that you can put in the mail on Friday night will go through our system and be delivered on Monday. So, with the except that what we would propose to eliminate is the Saturday delivery. Believe me, we don't take this lightly. I agree 100% with Fred that it is a very good part of our service, and it's something that we're the only ones that do. But the facts are this: we are losing first class mail at the rate of 7 to 8% a year. First class mail pays the freight. The contribution we get from that product keeps the 33,000 post offices open. It keeps our 200,000-plus routes delivering 6 days a week, and you have to make some choices. There is no substitution for first class. We can grow the package business. We're growing at double digit. We're also growing standard mail, but that the revenue and volume from that does not make up with what we lose on first class. And when you look ahead, it gets worse, and we've got to be making some responsible decisions.
What should the price of stamps be, a first-class stamp?
Right now it's 44 cents.
Right.
You know, we're looking probably next year to see it go up another 2 cents. When you compare us to other countries, we are a bargain. I mean, Germany, it's like 75 cents. Canada, it's 60 cents. It's a bargain because our people have done a very good job keeping the price low with good productivity on their part.
If you tried to raise the price of stamp to 50 cents, what would happen?
Well, it's my fear that the more you raise prices, the more you move people to alternative delivery like the internet. The single piece where you and I would put a stamp on a bill, that's probably less price sensitive. But when you change prices like advertising mail, people will either reduce the number of pieces they'd mail or go to the internet. We can't afford that.
Fred, from the carrier's perspective, what would eliminating Saturday delivery do for carriers on Mondays?
Workload-wise, Mondays would be extremely busy, yes. They're already busy after a holiday. When you look at the number of holiday weekends we have, it would be pretty busy, but we could handle it. I think the bigger fear is once you start to go down that road, depending what direction the Postal Service goes in with looking for new avenues of revenue, what's to stop them from then eliminating Tuesday delivery or Thursday delivery, and before long, you're not accomplishing the mission of the Postal Service for the American people anymore.
Frederick Rolando, he's president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Here in the studio, Patrick Donahue, he's Postmaster General of the United States.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
A leading social thinker on prospects for a third industrial revolution, how the merger of internet technology and renewable energy could transform the U.S. and the global economy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And let's go right to the phones to Walled Lake, Michigan. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I was just explaining to my wife what I was going to talk to you all about. This is frustrating to me because it seems that the solution is real simple and it's being ignored. The 2005 bill said you had 40 years to pre-fund. A year later, 2006 comes along, and some knucklehead makes it 10 years. Now, what we have here is this immense polite fiction that, you know, we have to accept this ridiculous requirement. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says the Congress establishes a post office. If they're trying to eliminate the post office, they're going to either have to have an act of Congress, going to have an amendment to the Constitution, none of which is going to work. So the question is, why do we have to accept this enormous polite fiction that we have to do this in 10 years. The simple solution is, hey, Congress, wake up, be reasonable, you know, and let's do this intelligently.
All right, Richard, how do you feel about that?
Well, Richard's correct in that that's exactly what happened. When the bill was originally, the idea of the original bill was to pre-fund over 40 years. And what happened was it was almost like signing up for a 40-year mortgage and getting it back in the mail and say you have to pay it in 10 years. And that's what's called a scoring issue with Congress, which we could take a whole hour to discuss,
but
so I'll stay away from that one.
And who pushed that?
It was a requirement by the Congressional Budget Office that the fact that you can only score over a 10-year period on a bill like that.
I see.
So that was the requirement. The thing that we are concerned about going forward is there's a couple things. Number one, we want to make sure that we're responsible with the retiree health benefits. That's why we've proposed our own solution around having our own health care system, which eliminates the pre-funding and also still provides excellent benefits for the employees. But the other problem we have going forward, I think, is the volume issue that I spoke about earlier. I agree 100% with the caller. The Postal Service is very important, will not be eliminated, but what we've got to do is make some changes so that we can stay in good financial footing.
How sure can you be that, in fact, what the current Congress doesn't want to do is simply to eliminate the post office?
This year we will deliver 165 billion pieces of mail. We will also, to Fred's point earlier, be delivering a substantial number of packages for FedEx and UPS. The Postal Service plays a very important role in American economy and society today, as we have for 200 years. There's nothing in the near future that I think would threaten that.
Fred, how convinced are you?
Well, there's certainly members of Congress that would love to see the Postal Service destroyed, that don't care for government, especially a successful agency like the Postal Service, that don't care for decent middle-class jobs or labor unions or anything else that the Postal Service stands for, and they would probably love to see it dismantled so that they can pick and choose and privatize it for corporate profit rather than to serve the American people like it was intended. So, yeah, there's certainly members of Congress that feel that way. But as Pat said, I mean, it's so much more than about the Postal Service. The Postal Service is a cornerstone for a $1.3 trillion postal industry affecting nearly 9 million workers in associated industries. So it's much bigger than us.
We've had several emails like this one from Johnny in McLean, Virginia, who says, could you please ask the Postmaster General to discuss the role of bulk mail in his business model?
Bulk mail, or we call advertising mail, is the largest percentage of volume we deliver today.
And it's gotten bigger and bigger.
It gets bigger and bigger. The thing of it is
I can hardly wait for Christmas. I'm telling you.
But you know what? It is the most effective way to advertise. The return on investment for direct mail or advertising mail is better than the internet, better than the TV, even better than radio. And but it's the most direct way to get in front of a customer's eyes, and it grows, and we know that there will be value in that going out into the future.
How do the carriers feel about bulk mail, Fred?
How do we feel about bulk mail? Oh, yeah. The same way we feel about all mail. We treat every piece of mail like that's our own. It's very personal to us, and we just anything that brings revenue to the company so we can continue to serve the people.
All right, to Naples, Florida. Good morning, Paul.
Hi. I got just a couple quick questions for the Postmaster General.
Sure.
He's on the radio taking calls and emails from people. Now, didn't that at some point cut into the Postal Service's business? I heard him last time he was on NPR saying that he mailed all those bills, and that's fine, but, you know.
So do I, by the way. So do I.
Well, he's complaining that new technology is cutting into part of his business model. Isn't this doing it? The phones didn't eliminate the Postal Service. And my second question is, I just got back from the Postal Service, actually. I build small electronics projects and use FlyRite boxes to mail them out to people because it's so cheap and I don't have to worry about weighing. My question is, you guys do a lot of stuff great. What is your plan to accentuate what you do very well and downplay some of the things that I think are frankly being replaced, like a lot of first-class stamps?
Well, from a first class stamp situation, that's a major threat. Phones, telegraph. There have been many other potential substitutions, but what we found here with the internet, it has been very easy for people to move to pay bills online, and that's what's really affected the first class volume. And it's to a large extent a generational thing. If you're comfortable growing up with a smartphone or a computer to do those kind of things, that's going to happen. From a standpoint of growth, a couple things are going on right now. Number one, we think that there's big opportunities in a product we recently came out with called Every Door Direct, and it's a very simple product that you can go right online, actually pick out the delivery routes that you want to deliver on, package your mail up, bring it in, give it to us. You don't have to worry about addressing. Our letter carriers do a great job delivering it. Then the day after you bring it in, we've made over the course of the last 5 months about $75 million in business on that. So customers see the value, and it's definitely growing. We have great opportunities still with the package business. And some of the other things we're looking at is our role in the digital world going forward. We think with what we provide from both a secure and a trusted third-party perspective from a Postal Service standpoint, there is secure digital messaging in the future that needs to have somebody that can provide that trust that you don't have in the systems right now.
Here's an email from Ryan in New Hampshire. He says, what about the multi-million-dollar contract with Netflix? They've threatened to cancel contract with the post office because they can't guarantee two-day delivery service with a five-day work week. That's a big contract. What about that, Fred?
Well, I understand their concern. I mean, with five-day delivery, that's just one of the many businesses. I mean, think in terms of the pharmaceuticals and so forth, the people that depend on Saturday delivery. It's a major concern with the thought of cutting back to less than six-day delivery.
So are you going to fight that, Fred?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to fight that?
The five-day delivery?
You bet.
Oh, yes. We're gonna step up our efforts at all levels.
And what do you think the reaction's going to be from the Congress?
Well, there's quite a few people in Congress that are not in favor of eliminating six-day delivery. We've got a resolution in the House of Representatives that's got almost 200 co-sponsors with regard to maintaining six-day delivery. So I think we've got quite a bit of support in Congress.
And here's an email from Robert, who says, he doesn't tell me where he is, but he says, apparently our local post office pays rent for the space he uses in a federal building constructed as a post office and federal courthouse. Why does the post office pay rent to the federal government? How widespread is this? If so, what does it cost the Postal Service yearly? I think it's absurd. Patrick.
We own about 70% of the space that we operate in, and we lease about 65 to 70% of our facilities.
From the federal government?
No, from many private citizens. Here's what happens. Most post offices are leased. Most large processing facilities are owned. So we spend a lot of money, but probably about $1.5 billion a year in rent for our buildings, and that's done primarily with public, just citizens that happen to own those buildings.
So, for example, going back to what you were saying earlier, if you could locate a post office in a grocery store in a small community, would you pay for rental space there? How would that work?
What we do is what we're proposing would be to set a contract up with them. They could handle the whole business. That way, what you do is, to a large extent, in a small grocery store, if you pay a couple $1,000s a year, you'll cover their electric bill and make life easier for them keeping those small grocery stores open out in the rural areas.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Teresa.
Hello. Hi. My question is about customer service. I've lived most of my life in the Midwest. My father was a letter carrier. My aunt was a letter carrier. And it was a very important part of my life when I was a kid growing up to go to the post office and buy extra postage because we wanted to support the United States Post Office. And today I have struggled with a couple of branches in the Midwest, in the state of Illinois, Indiana specifically, where the customer service was intimidating. And it wasn't a very pleasant experience. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit maybe about how, if you are going to be going into the supermarkets, I guess, or into the small grocery stores or keeping the branches that you do have open, how are you going to manage customer service so that we can have a really good experience and pleasant experience and know that it's going to continue forward that way?
Customer service is critically important to us, whether it's delivery or if it's your personal experience at the post office, or even if you use our call centers or our online services. It's an ongoing issue. You're exactly right. You always want to make sure that you are talking with the employees and emphasizing the importance of good customer service.
But you can talk to them. You can say to them, you need to do this. But who's standing over them and watching? So often I go into a local post office right around lunchtime when an awful lot of people go into the post office, and it's down to one line.
That's something that we should never do. And that's something that I will tell you, we constantly talk to our people about. If you're going to go on lunch at a different time than when your customers go on lunch so you can provide great service.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Walter in Chicago who says, I run a company that depends on using USPS for delivery because of its low cost. USPS takes a few days longer than UPS, which means that we field more calls asking, where is my package? Now, if you remove Saturday delivery, I don't know how we can keep using USPS without significantly increasing our customer complaints.
Well, that's something we've got to work through, number one, from a standpoint.
How are you going to do that?
Well, it depends on when we take the mail in and how we work the mail through the system. If UPS and FedEx don't deliver on Saturday now, we do. And what we'd have to do is work specifically with that customer to find out what delays that he or she's experiencing and how to resolve this.
To Susan in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you very much, and good morning to both you and your guests.
Morning.
What I'd like to point out is that the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act was passed by Republican-controlled House, Senate, and Presidency. And I would have to ask why anyone would propose to ask a company to fund their health care pension 75 years in advance unless you're deliberately trying to get them to fail.
Fred.
Well, I think Pat touched on it a little bit earlier. It has to do with their internal scoring issues. Anytime they're dealing with, even though it's our own money, if it's something they have access to, it's going to score. It's ironic that the payments began back in 2006, the $5.5 billion payments. That whole thing was set up as a scoring issue for about $17 billion. That we received from a surplus in the Civil Service Fund. And in order to give us that money, it was scored by setting up these payments. So it's really ironic that scoring is what got us into this situation, as scoring seems to be what's preventing the Congress from fixing it. But, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And here's a question from Carl in Kalamazoo, Michigan, with a suggestion to help post office income. It would be a natural for selling lotto tickets nationwide or selling ads on stamps. What do you think?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion over that over the years. Matter of fact, there are a couple of the bills that are in Congress now that allow us to get into different products going forward. And
we do, even?
Lotto, I'm not so sure. I mean, there are certain things you worry about selling in your lobby. Maybe we should run our own lottery and make some money off of
that. Well, perhaps. And Fred, from your perspective, how much good do you think these demonstrations around the country today are going to do?
You know, I hope they're going to get the attention of the public because, you know, letter carriers, the men and women I represent are part of every neighborhood in the country. It's really personal to them because they know all the people, they know all the families. We're involved in so many things within the community, whether it's the food drive or the carrier alert program where we're looking out for the elderly, or the city readiness initiative where we're prepared to distribute medicines in the event of a biological attack, or just the fact that we've got the privilege of being in the right place at the right time.
And I've got to stop you there, but I want you to know I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I want to see the post office continue. Thank you both for being with us. Patrick Donahue, Postmaster General, Fred Rolando, President at the National Association of Letter Carriers. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.